welcome back to part two of Charles Manson and Helter Skelter. If you have not listened to part one, stop listening right now. Go back to part one and listen. This is really one large episode broken into two simultaneously released episodes. So, you gotta listen to part one before you listen to part two. If you've listened to part one, let's jump into this. We gotta talk about the Manson murders. That's what everybody thinks about when they think of the Charles Manson family. But what a lot of people don't know is that the most famous murders were not necessarily the first. So we're starting out with what's called the Hinman murder. Started on July 25, 1969. There was a man who was associated with the Manson family. His name was Gary Hinman. If I remember correctly, he was a music teacher, which is odd. But he was also a drug pusher. And he, I believe, in his basement made a psychedelic drug called mescaline. I don't know anything about that. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that right. But he apparently made and then sold it to the family. The family then sold it to other people and tried to make a profit off it. The Manson family started getting complaints from their quote-unquote clients, and they went to Hinman and wanted to get the money back because apparently, according to them, the drugs that they sold them were defective. But Hinman didn't have the money anymore. Manson was also under the impression, false impression, that Hinman had just gotten an inheritance of $20,000, and Manson felt that he was entitled to it. Because, of course, he's Manson, the chosen one. Everybody should give him exactly what he wants. So Manson sent the man, Bobby Beausoleil, who we talked about earlier, to Hinman's house to scare him into giving the money to the family. And along with Bobby Beausoleil, Susan Atkins and Mary Brunner went along. Hinman claimed he didn't have any money. So that was bad news for him. The next day, Manson came to the house and was threatening Hinman, and he actually slashed his ear and cheek with a sword. And I mean like an actual sword. It wasn't a big knife. Manson had a legitimate sword. I don't know where he got it, but doesn't it just seem fitting that this psycho would have a sword? Anyway. So he slashed his ear and cheek with a sword, and then he left. Now, Beausoleil knew that if he took Hinman to the hospital, he would go to prison because they've basically been terrorizing this guy for a day and a half. So finally, at Manson's urging, which is important, Bobby Beausoleil kills Gary Hinman by stabbing him multiple times. And then, weirdly, but understandably based on their incredibly messed up motives, Beausoleil used Hinman's blood to write political piggy on the wall, and then he drew a Black Panther paw print in blood on the wall, hoping, of course, that this would set off the Helter Skelter race war. Unfortunately for Beausoleil, he left a clear fingerprint, and he was found bloody and with a bloody knife and was arrested and charged. It was a pretty clear-cut case. He definitely did it. There was no connection to Manson at this point yet. It was seemed to be a completely isolated incident, and it was technically a completely isolated incident because it was the first incident. But Bobby Beausoleil was the only person at this point who was being charged with murder. But then Saturday, August 9, 1969 rolls around, and it was clear that Manson had been planning something for quite some time. He would have his family go on what he called creepy crawlies. So it was nighttime, and they would basically practice being stealthy. If I remember correctly, they broke into homes unnoticed. They didn't actually steal anything, but they were clearly practicing for a bigger event. And that event happened on, again, Saturday, August 9th. 1969. It was just after midnight. Now, I'm going to tell this story, and admittedly, it's going to be a little bit disjointed. And that is purposeful, because that is how the information came out. It's a story of mayhem and chaos and insanity, and nobody really knows what's happening. And so I'm going to kind of tell it as it was experienced by people who discovered the murders, and then I'll kind of tell you what happened, kind of skip to the end. I'm not really going to tell you about the investigation, because there's too much information, and to condense it into one episode is just impossible. I mean, it requires a book, basically, which is what I used for research, as I said. But yeah, bear with me here. I'm going to relay the information as clearly as possible, but it is going to be intentionally a bit disjointed. So, there is a secluded house at 10050 Cielo Drive. The house was a house that Manson had been to before, because it was at one point owned by the music executive Terry Melcher. And there's so much information, I couldn't keep it all straight. I don't remember if he still owned the house but wasn't living in it, or if he had sold it. But either way, Manson had been there at some point. But now it was being lived in by other people. It was very secluded. There was a driveway with a gate. It was clear why this location was picked. So sometime between 12:30 and 1 a.m., the neighbor, which was about 100 yards away at 10070 Cielo Drive, heard what sounded like 4 or 5 gunshots. I believe it was the Mrs. at the neighbor, Mrs. Cott, I believe her name was, K-O-T-T. She heard what she thought was gunshots, but she didn't hear anything else. She went back to sleep. She didn't remember exactly what time it was, but she estimated it was around 12:30 to 1 a.m. Now, around 12:40, a man named Tim Ireland, who was a camp counselor for an overnight camp, heard a man screaming. And from what he could tell, it sounded like the man was screaming something along the lines of, "Oh God, don't do this, don't do this, oh God, please don't do this." And then abruptly, the scream was cut off after about 10 to 15 seconds, which is almost worse than hearing the scream. Hearing the scream and then hearing it just cut off is extremely chilling. And Ireland felt the same way. He got permission from another camp counselor to investigate. He drove around, didn't see or hear anything suspicious, and just wrote it off. Other people in the area called in different sounds, screaming, gunshots, things of that nature. There seemed to be a clear indication that something was happening, but there wasn't enough information for any type of investigation to start. It was all very disjointed. Nobody knew where it was coming from. Nobody knew what was happening. It was just kind of a waiting game at this point. And around 4:30 a.m., Steve Shannon delivered the paper to 10050 Cielo Drive, and he heard nothing unusual, but he did notice what looked like a cut telephone line hanging over the gate at 10050. And then at 8 a.m., the housekeeper for the house, 10050 Cielo Drive, showed up to work. Her name was Winifred Chapman. She's an African-American woman, and she also noticed the cut wire and became immediately worried. Now, when she went through the gate, she noticed in the driveway there was an unfamiliar car. It was a white Rambler parked in the driveway. She didn't think really anything of that at the beginning, because it was not uncommon for guests to stay overnight at the house. So she went through the service entrance and checked one of the phones. Phone line was dead. At this point, she is quite nervous. So she goes through the dining room and is walking towards the living room, and she sees 2 blue steamer trunks that were not there when she had left the day before. Someone had brought clothes. But what was more concerning, obviously, was blood was on the trunks, on the floor next to them, and on 2 towels nearby. She could not see the entire living room based on the architecture of the house, but she could see a lot of blood. And through the open front door, she could see a body. And at that point, she ran screaming from the house, past the White Rambler, and then that point, because of the view she had of the car, she noticed there was also a dead body in that car, again, setting her off into more hysterics. And so she ran to the neighbor. The neighbors at 10070 were not home or did not answer the door one way or the other. I don't remember. So she ran to 10090 Cielo Drive, banging on the door, screaming, "Murder, death, bodies, blood." She was so hysterical she couldn't even form a coherent sentence. 15-year-old Jim Assen lived at 10090. He was part of a, I didn't write it down, but kind of like a youth law enforcement intern. I don't even know the word for it. But he was in like a youth version of the LAPD, so to speak. And he called the police emergency line. And because of his quote unquote training with this youth version of the LAPD, he noted the time exactly at 8:33 a.m. So after the call to the emergency line, police officers, of course, started showing up to the Cielo Drive house. Now, the first officer on the scene was an officer named Jerry DeRosa. And there's some discrepancies in the reports on what time different officers showed up and who got there, when, and et cetera, et cetera. But it seems clear that for sure DeRosa was the first officer on the scene. And he got there and inspected the White Rambler. He saw a body inside in the driver's seat, but slumped towards the passenger seat. Clearly a male, Caucasian, pants and shirt drenched in blood. He was young, probably in his teens. At that point, Officer William Wisenhunt showed up, and then shortly thereafter, most likely, a officer named Robert Burbridge showed up. And then the three officers then proceeded to go up towards the house to inspect what they could see. They were armed. They weren't sure if the killers were still there or not. The officers saw two bodies in the lawn past the front door. And indicative of the violent nature of the crime, according to them, the bodies looked like two mannequins that were dipped in red paint. The first body was 18 to 20 feet from the open front door into the lawn. It was a male, Caucasian, around 30-ish years old. He was lying on his side with his head on his right arm and his left hand clutching the grass. His head and his face were beaten badly and torso and limbs punctured by dozens of stab wounds. The second body was about 25 feet beyond the first body. It was a female, Caucasian, late 20s. She was lying on her back with her arms thrown out. She was wearing a full-length nightgown, which had probably been white, but due to the multiple stab wounds, the original color was impossible to tell. Wisenhunt and Burbridge went around cautiously the house looking for a way in. They went towards the north end of the residence. They didn't want to go through the front door for safety reasons, of course. And as they were going around the north end of the residence, they saw a screen had been removed and was leaning up against the house, and there was also a horizontal slit along the bottom of the screen. This seemed like the likely entrance point that the killer or killers used. Burbridge and Wisenhunt did not want to use that same entrance, for obvious reasons, and so they found another open window that they could see went into an empty room, so they climbed in. Once they were in the house, DeRosa then approached from the front door. As he was approaching, he saw multiple patches of blood on the walkway, by the hedges, in between the hedges, and then on the lower half of the front door. And I believe from context that it was on the lower half on the inside of the door, but it didn't actually say. It just said lower half of the front door. In blood, someone had written the word pig. Burbridge also found two pieces of wood in the living room. They looked like pieces of a broken gun grip. And in the living room was a long couch draped with a huge American flag. On the other side of the sofa, once they got into the room completely and were able to see everything, they found another body. It's a female, young, blonde, very pregnant. And she was on her left side in the fetal position. Blood was smeared over her entire body. And there was a white nylon rope looped around her neck twice. And then the rope went over the rafters in the ceiling and then went to another body that was about 4 feet away. The rope was also looped over this victim. It was a man. It was looped over his neck twice. And there was a bloody towel covering his face. He was also covered in blood. After finding the bodies and determining that there were no killers yet in the house, the officers went outside and saw the guest house. The guest house was set back, I believe, about 60 yards from the main house. And the officers determined as they were approaching the guest house that there was a man and a dog in the guest house. They heard the dog bark, and then they heard the man trying to tell the dog to be quiet. William Garrettson was a young man who was hired to be the caretaker of the house, and he was in the guest house. The police busted in there, immediately grabbed him, put him on the ground, handcuffed him. At some point, they read him his rights. He claimed to have no idea what happened. Officers at first did not believe him. And as they were going out of the guest house and through the yard towards the driveway, he saw the bodies in the yard and he misidentified them. The woman was so badly brutalized and there's so much blood that he misidentified her as Winifred Chapman. He actually thought it was an African-American woman because of the condition of the body. He saw the other body as well and he misidentified it because he was under the impression that that person was the homeowner's younger brother, which is not the case, but the officers, of course, didn't know that he was mistaken. He claimed he had been awake during the night listening to music and writing letters, but he had heard nothing. The officers thought this highly unlikely based on the violent nature of the crime, and he was arrested and was, at the beginning, a clear suspect for the murders. Now, I'm just going to get this out of the way right now. Obviously, William Garrettson did not commit these murders. It was true that he was in the guest house the entire time, but based on the distance from the house as well as the volume that his stereo was set at, he heard and saw nothing. He was just in the wrong place at the wrong time and was fortunate enough that he wasn't caught up in the murders and killed himself. But he had really nothing to add to the investigation. And eventually, after multiple polygraphs and figuring out what really happened, he was released and went on with his life. So at about this point, the detectives had determined that the house at 10050 Cielo Drive was being lived in by the famous movie director Roman Polanski and his wife. Roman Polanski is pretty famous at this point, especially since 1968, the movie Rosemary's Baby came out. It was a huge, massive hit. He was the director. He was incredibly famous at this point. However, he was not home on August 9, 1969. He was in Europe working on a movie. Polanski's agent showed up to the scene of the crime around noon, slightly before noon. His name was William Tennant. He did not recognize the man in the White Rambler, but as he was given a gruesome tour around the house by the officers, he was able to identify the other four. The man in the lawn he identified as Wojtek Frykowski. He was a good friend of Polanski's. He was a struggling actor and a writer, and he was basically living off his father's wealth while also enjoying the socialite life of Hollywood. The woman in the lawn was identified as Abigail Folger. She was the heiress to the Folger's coffee fortune and the girlfriend of Frykowski and had become good friends with the Polanskis through knowing Wojtek Frykowski. Wojtek Frykowski, by the way, is born in, I think, Poland. His name wasn't Wojtek, it was a nickname, but I can't pronounce his real name. But his nickname was this Wojtek. I know it's kind of an odd name, but just a little side note there. He was born in Poland, I believe. In the living room, Tennant was able to identify the two bodies as Sharon Tate and Jay Sebring. Tate was an up-and-coming movie star and the wife of Polanski. She hadn't had a huge hit yet, from what I understand, but she was talented and seemed like she was on the verge of her big break. But then she got married and got pregnant and was taking some time off. She was in some movies for sure, and she was known, but not as well known as she hoped to be someday. And then Jay Sebring, very famous. He was a hairstylist in Hollywood, and he had some very famous clients, men like Henry Fonda, Steve McQueen, and many others. He also liked to race cars. He was good friends and raced cars with Paul Newman. He was well known in the right circles in Hollywood. He was also the former boyfriend of Sharon Tate, and despite that, he stayed good friends with her and Roman Polanski after they got married. Now, through the investigation, it was determined that three of the victims had been shot. The John Doe in The Rambler, Jay Sebring, and Wojtek Farkowski. Of the five victims, only John Doe had not been stabbed. So he had a defensive slash wound on his wrist, but otherwise he was shot. The four others had been stabbed many, many times. And the wound patterns were not dissimilar from the wounds that would be caused by a bayonet. Sebring had also been hit in the face at least once, and Frykowski had been struck on the head with a blunt object many times. It was believed, I think it was later proven, but it was believed that they were beaten with the pistol butt, and that was why they found those wooden pieces. They actually beat them so many times that they broke the wooden pieces off the butt of a pistol. John Doe was eventually identified as Stephen Parent. He is an 18-year-old acquaintance of Gerritsen. Gerritsen said that he did not know him well. He picked him up as a hitchhiker and said, "Hey, if you're ever in the area, stop by. I live in the guest house." And Stephen Parent took him up on it. I believe Parent wanted to sell Gerritsen a stereo. And after Gerritsen said no, Parent left shortly thereafter. He came for a visit around 11:45 p.m. on technically August 8, 1969, and then was basically just in the wrong place at the wrong time in the White Rambler. The coroner's report for this crime, really, it's pretty cold as coroner's reports go, but it really shows the incredible brutality of the crime. So I'm going to tell you what the reports say. The coroner's report for Sharon Tate. Cause of death: multiple stab wounds of the chest and back, penetrating the heart, lungs, and liver, causing massive hemorrhage. Victim was stabbed 16 times, five of which wounds were in and of themselves fatal. Just, the killers were just going crazy. And it's, in Sharon Tate's case, it's even more horrific to me because she was 8 months pregnant. And according to the coroner, if the bodies had been found in time, they could have done an emergency cesarean section, C-section, excuse me. I'm losing my, it's getting late here. Anyway, could have done an immediate C-section and the baby most likely would have been saved. But bodies were not found in time, and unfortunately, the baby also died, which is just so incredibly sad to me. It makes it even more sad. It's a tragedy no matter which way you slice it. But, ooh, slice was a bad way to say that. I shouldn't have said that. I didn't mean that as a pun. But no matter which way you look at it, it's a tragedy. But, I mean, for crying out loud, the woman was pregnant. And she begged for her life so that she could have her baby. And these awful human beings did not care. And you'll see that later on. Just horrific. But back to their coroner's report. Jay Sebring, cause of death: exsanguination. The victim literally bled to death. Victim had been stabbed seven times and shot once, at least three of the stab wounds, as well as the gunshot wound, being in and of itself fatal. So he fought for his life, that's for sure. Abigail Folger, victim, had been stabbed 28 times. It did not go into any more details, at least in the report that I read, about where or how many of those would have been fatal. But I mean, for crying out loud, she'd stabbed 28 times. Just unbelievable brutality. But then you get to Wojtek Frykowski, coroner's report. Victim was shot twice, struck over the head 13 times with a blunt object, and stabbed 51 times. Oh, gosh, makes you sick. And then Stephen Parent, unfortunate, wrong place at the wrong time. Victim had one defensive slash wound and had been shot 4 times. I mean, this was not your average, if there is such a thing, average run-of-the-mill murder. This was a shocking slaughterhouse murder. Clearly, the killers were there not just to murder, but to shock people. And nobody could understand why. This murder case became the most covered and most famous murder case, with the exception of the JFK assassination. Newspapers throughout the world were all over this, and it caused a lot of issues. There was some pretty irresponsible reporting. I'm not going to go into it too much, but the victims were smeared a bit. There were talks about it being satanic and ritualistic in nature. Not true. There were talks about there was a towel put over the head of one of the victims. I think it was Jay Sebring, if I remember correctly. And because of irresponsible reporting, that towel in some reports was a KKK hood, which is a horrible thing to talk about. You know, nobody wants to be part of the KKK. There were talks about the victims being part of a sexual ring where they would have ritualistic orgies, and then this murder stemmed from that. None of this was true, and the reporting was irresponsible, but it's an insight into the incredible sensation that this caused throughout the United States, but especially within Hollywood. It reverberated. It was earth-shattering murders. So in that way, Manson got what he wanted, although nobody knew it yet at the time. One thing that did happen was a lot of people assumed that this was something to do with drugs. Drug deal gone bad. There were some drugs found in the house, very small amounts, you know, marijuana, the type of things that, you know, Hollywood is known for. But the joke was dark comedy. The joke was, after the murders were reported, toilets throughout Hollywood were flushing because everybody was getting rid of their drugs in case they were questioned by police. But what actually happened? Now, I'm skipping over all the investigation. The investigation was, in my mind, poor. I mean, this is 1969. It wasn't like they have the investigative practices that we have now. Of course, things were not nearly as rigid and not nearly as scientific, but there was just a lack of communication, and connections that should have been made earlier weren't made in terms of murders that were obviously perpetrated by the same people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm kind of skipping over that part. If you want to dig more into the investigation aspect of the crime, go ahead and read Vincent Bugliosi's book. But what actually happened? It became clear that Manson ordered Tex Watson to go to 10050 Cielo Drive and kill everyone in the house, quote, as gruesomely as possible. So Watson took Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Linda Kasabian. Now, when they got to the house, Watson shot Steve Parent to death in the car. Parent wasn't supposed to be there, but he kind of surprised them and they blew him away. Watson, Krenwinkel, and Atkins then broke into the house. Kasabian was left outside by the gate as a lookout and getaway driver. Tate, Sebring, Folger, and Furkowski were forced to gather in the living room. It was more than likely that Folger had probably gone to bed. She was in her nightgown. So they basically, wherever the people were in the house, they apprehended them, and they were all brought into the living room. At that point, Sebring was shot and stabbed, and I believe it's thought that Watson killed him. Tex Watson shot and stabbed him. And then Folger and Frankowski at that point tried to make their escape. They were chased down by Krenwinkel and Tex Watson, and both of them were killed by Krenwinkel and Watson. And then after the two in the front yard were killed, Watson came back into the house, and it was Watson and or Atkins maybe working together, or it was most likely Susan Atkins who killed Sharon Tate. And then Atkins was the one who used Sharon Tate's blood to write pig on the front door. And later on, I'll get into a little bit of Atkins' testimony, but she is one cold-hearted bitch. Pardon my French. But, oh man, if you want to see evil, just read up on some of the statements she made after the murders. Horrible. But it wasn't done. The Tate murders are the famous part of the Manson murder trial, but it wasn't the only thing that Manson and his family did. So early morning on the next day, like 1 a.m. on August 10, Sunday, 1969, husband and wife Leno and Rosemary LaBianca were driving home from a day trip, and they stopped at a newsstand owned by an acquaintance named John Fokianos. And they stopped there, chatted for a few minutes. It seems weird to me that a guy was running a newsstand at 1 a.m., but I guess that was the thing. As far as anybody knows, John Fokianos was the last person, with the exception of the murderers, to see the LaBiancas alive. A little bit about the LaBiancas. Leno was the president of a chain of L.A. supermarkets. He was of Italian descent and was 44 years old. And Rosemary owned a dress shop, which was very successful. She was 38. So they were well-to-do. And they had spent the day with it was Leno's stepdaughter and Rosemary's daughter from a previous marriage, Susan. They spent the day with her and then dropped her off and went home. Now, that night, 8:30 p.m. on Sunday night, Frank Struthers, who was, again, Rosemary's 15-year-old son from her previous marriage, came home. He had been on a vacation with friends, came home that night. When he got home, he noticed the shades were drawn down, which was abnormal, and it immediately made him a little bit wary, and the doors locked. He knocked on the door and got no response. Immediately got very scared and went to a payphone and called his sister, Susan. Susan called her boyfriend, a man named Joe Dorgan. Susan was in her 20s, I believe. It's like 20 or 21. She calls her boyfriend, Joe Dorgan, and they go to the house, meet up with Frank, and then using, I believe, the back door where they had hidden a spare key, the three enter the LaBianca's house. Susan stayed in the kitchen, and Frank and Joe investigated. And they quickly found Leno sprawled on his back in the living room between the couch and the chair, clearly dead, and they ran out of the house, ran to the neighbor, and the neighbor would not let them in, so they asked her to call the police, but they didn't actually believe that she would do it, so they went to a different neighbor. That neighbor let them in. They were so distraught that they weren't able to call the police, so the neighbor called the police for them. So then police show up and they go into the LaBianca's house and found, again, a slaughterhouse, butchery, basically. Leno was found dead. He had a pillowcase over his head. A cord from a lamp was knotted very tightly around his neck, and his hands were tied behind his back with a leather thong of some sort. There was an ivory-handled carving fork protruding from his stomach. He had multiple stab wounds in his abdomen, and someone had carved war in the flesh of his stomach. Then, investigating in the rest of the house in the master bedroom, they found Rosemary LaBianca. She was lying face down on the floor in a large pool of blood. She had so many stab wounds, the police didn't even initially count them. And her hands were not tied, but she did have a pillowcase on her head, like Leno, and a lamp cord around her neck. After the investigation proceeded a little bit and the pillowcases were taken off of the heads of the bodies, it was also found that Leno had a knife lodged in his throat. It was a knife that was determined to be part of a matching set owned by the LaBiancas. On the north wall, high up on the living room wall, someone had written "Death to Pigs" in blood. And on the south wall, high up on the wall again, even higher on the wall, it just said "Rise." And then on the refrigerator door, someone had written "Helter Skelter," except they spelled it H-E-A-L-T-E-R, Skelter. So they spelled it incorrectly. It was all written in blood. Now, despite the similarities, police initially ruled that the two cases, the Tate murders and the LaBianca murders, were unrelated. And that's what I mean when I talk about communication and poor investigative work in my mind. I'm not trying to be judgmental in any way. When I say poor investigative work, I don't mean to impugn the detectives that were actually part of it. I mean to say that we've come a long way in investigating crime. Just the techniques and there was some political things involved as well, were not up to what I would consider good investigative work. But 1969 was a long time ago. The detectives were good at their job, but they were hamstrung by just the times that they lived in. And so cases were being investigated by two separate teams, and at best they said maybe it was a copycat, but not a related incident. And again, the autopsy reports indicated quite a bit of brutality. Leno, cause of death, multiple stab wounds. Victim had 12 stab wounds plus 14 puncture wounds made by double-tined fork, for a total of 26 separate wounds, any one of six of which could in and of itself have been fatal. Rosemary, cause of death, again, multiple stab wounds. Victim had been stabbed a total of 41 times, any one of six of which, again, could in and of itself have been fatal. All of Leno's stab wounds were on his front. There were no defensive wounds indicating that he had been tied up while being murdered. And then 36 of the 41 of Rosemary's wounds were on her back and buttocks. So she was not tied up, most likely. Pillowcases over the head were probably done post-mortem for reasons unknown. So again, skipping over a bit of the investigation phase of this whole deal. And I'll get into how police ended up catching Manson, but I'm skipping over the nitty-gritty. Manson, apparently, when Watson, Atkins, Krenwinkel, and Kasabian got back to the hideout, which was a place called Span Ranch, after the Tate murders, Manson was displeased by the sloppiness of the murders, which I don't understand. This is another indication of his craziness. He tells them to do it as gruesomely as possible, and then he gets upset that it's sloppy. It doesn't make sense. So he himself personally took a group of his followers, and they went driving around that night looking for more victims. In the car was Manson, Tex Watson again, Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, Linda Kasabian, and Leslie Van Houten, and another man named Steve, nicknamed Clem Grogan. They drove around for several hours, and it seems, for the most part, that the LaBiancas' choice of them being the victim was pretty random. There was a house nearby the LaBiancas that Manson had been to before with an association with the family. It was a person who lived there, was associated with the family. So it could have just been he knew the area, but fairly random. There was no underlying cause that anybody has ever found of why the LaBiancos were murdered other than bad luck. So once they picked the house, Manson and Tex entered and subdued the couple, and they told them that they would not be hurt. They were just there to rob them. Manson then left the house and instructed Patricia Krenwinkel and Van Houten to go into the house and murder the couple. Now, I was fuzzy on the details at this point. If I remember correctly, well, actually, I don't remember. I don't remember if at this point Grogan and Manson actually left or if they waited in the car. So, sorry about that. So, Leno at this point realizes their promise of not hurting them is BS. And so he starts to struggle, and that's when Watson stabs him in the neck. Rosemary from the master bedroom hears her husband struggling and screaming, and she also starts to struggle, and she puts up a pretty valiant effort. Van Houten held her down while Krenwinkel stabbed her, but then the knife bent because they were being savages. And so they yelled for Watson to come help them because Rosemary was putting up a pretty good struggle and they were worried that she was going to escape. So Watson comes in and gave Van Houten another knife, which then she used to stab Rosemary until Rosemary was dead. Krenwinkel was then the one who carved war into Leno's stomach and stuck the fork in his stomach. And she was the one who wrote the words in blood on the wall and on the refrigerator. And then this part to me, for some reason, this was just a little sentence that was in the article that I read. But it said the killers showered in the LaBianca's house and then pet their dogs. Like, that to me was just the most screwed up part. Not the most screwed up part. I mean, let's be honest here. But it was just so weird to me that they could murder these people so horrifically and then pet their dog like normal human beings and then just leave. Just to me, that was more indicative of a lot of other actions of just how disassociated with reality these people were. It's very strange. Now, I was fuzzy, like I said, about when Manson left, but from the context of what I was reading, it seemed like Manson left with Linda Kasabian in a car, and then the other killers, the actual people that did the deed, left later. But regardless, Manson had gotten in the car with Kasabian, and he had Rosemary's wallet with him, and originally his plan was to drop it off in a black neighborhood, the goal being a black man hopefully would find the wallet and use the credit cards and then be framed for the crime. But then he changed his mind. He said, no, I wanted to hide it. He somewhere else in a gas station bathroom. He told Linda to put it in the gas station bathroom. She actually hid it, and it wasn't found for 4 months. So how did Manson and his followers finally get caught? That was not easy to do. For a while, there was not much happening on these cases. The investigations seemed to have stalled. There were little bits and pieces here and there, but nothing that they could really put together into a coherent case. And for quite some time, there was absolutely no connection to the Manson family. In October, 2 months after the murders, Manson and 24 of his family were arrested during a raid on a place called Barker Ranch. Barker Ranch was an area in California where the Manson family had been squatting, basically. And there was a raid. They were arrested for charges ranging from arson to grand theft auto. Now, during the raid, this is very important, two women ran out of the bushes asking for protection. One of those women was a woman named Kitty Lutzinger. They said they were fleeing from the Manson family and they were looking for protection. And coincidentally, detectives had been looking for Kitty for a while because she was the girlfriend of Bobby Beausoleil, who had been arrested and charged with the murder of Gary Hinman. Kitty started to break the case open because she told detectives that Manson himself had sent Beausoleil and Susan Atkins to Hinman's home. And Kitty also recalled another conversation where Susan Atkins had told her and some other girls in the family that she had been in a fight with a man and that she had stabbed him 3 or 4 times in the leg. And at first, this seemed like a non sequitur, but then detectives started to think about some things, and they realized that Gary Hinman had not been stabbed in the legs, but Wojtek Frykowski had. So suddenly some dots were being connected, but it was still very early in the process. Now, one of the women that had been picked up in the Barker Ranch raid was Susan Atkins. Although she was booked under the name Sadie Mae Glutz, she refused to be called Susan Atkins. She wanted to be called Sadie Mae Glutz because that was the name that Charles Manson had given her. I don't even know. Don't even ask. After Kitty Lutzinger and her confession, Susan Atkins, Sadie Mae Glutz, whatever you want to call her, is booked for Hinman's murder, and she is moved to the Sybil Brand Institute, which is a women's detention facility in L.A. In the same institute is a woman named Virginia Graham. Now, Susan Atkins liked to talk. From all the evidence that comes to light, Susan Atkins seems to be the one that relished her role in the murders more than anybody else. She seemed to genuinely enjoy it, horrific as that sounds. And she was a bit of a bragger. And when she bragged, Virginia Graham and another inmate named Ronnie Howard were there to listen. So the other inmates called her Crazy Sadie because they knew her as Sadie Mae Glutz. She would laugh and sing at inappropriate times. She'd start go-go dancing at random times, and she would brag about her sexual experience while propositioning other inmates. She was nuts. Straight bonkers. Susan admitted to Virginia that she had helped kill Gary Hinman. She said that a man, we now know as Bobby Beausoleil, had held Gary while Susan stabbed him 4 or 5 times. And according to Graham, Susan had said it, quote, just like it was a perfectly natural thing to do every day of the week. Completely remorseless. Just normal conversation. Susan also admitted to Virginia that she had met a man named Charlie, whose orders she followed without question. Because according to Susan, Charlie was Jesus. So this is all happening in October, and then into November. On November 6, Susan Atkins admitted to Virginia Graham that she was involved in the Tate murders. And she admitted it in a way that was like bragging, because she talked about it a little bit, and she was getting very excited and talking very fast. And Virginia said something along the lines of, well, who did it? And Susan Atkins said, you're looking at her. And Virginia Graham thought she was kidding. She thought she was just bragging, you know, trying to be big stuff because she was crazy. And Atkins admitted that they did not know who the people in the house were, but they had picked the Cielo Drive house because it was isolated and they wanted to make sure that they committed a murder that would shock the world. And she also claimed that the Manson family had a hit list of other celebrities that they were going to murder. Hit list included people like Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, Tom Jones, Frank Sinatra, Steve McQueen. Very famous people were starting to get a little bit worried. She had, like I said, no remorse. At one point, Graham asked Atkins if it bothered her to kill a pregnant woman. And Atkins replied, quote, well, I thought you understood. I loved her, and in order for me to kill her, I was killing part of myself when I killed her. What? I don't even know what that means, but She's nuts. Atkins sickened me, honestly. She talked about how she had wanted to cut the baby out of Sharon Tate after she murdered her. And I guess take the baby with her, but she didn't have time. She talked about how she had tasted Sharon Tate's blood and how it was so wonderful. She compared killing to sex in terms of how it made her feel. It's just gross. I mean, she, oh boy. Dark. She was and maybe still is, hard to say, an incredibly messed up individual. Atkins tried to explain to Virginia Graham what Helter Skelter was, but she was so animated that Graham had trouble following her. But as Graham understood it, incorrectly it turns out, she thought that Helter Skelter was a group of people that were choosing select people and executing them to free them from this world. And she does remember Atkins saying, and this is a quote, "You have to have real love in your heart to do this for people." She's talking about murdering people. What? Boy. All right, moving on. I'm just going to leave that right there. I'm just going to leave that. I'm not even going to touch that one. Now, in November of 1969, detectives interviewed a man named Al Springer. He was a motorcycle gang member, and the gang that he was a part of had ties to the family. And he said that Manson bragged about killing people days after the Tate murder. So detectives are starting to put things together. Now, Virginia Graham and Ronnie Howard finally decided, hey, I don't think Susan Atkins, or Crazy Sadie as they knew her, is making this stuff up. They reported to LAPD, and the case kind of coalesced. In late November, Tex Watson was arrested in Texas, and then I think Leslie Van Houten and Patricia Krenwinkel were both arrested later, as well as Charles Manson and Susan Atkins were already in prison from the Barker raid. And then finally, all of this comes together. They get all this different testimony, at least enough testimony, that on December 8, 1969, Manson, Watson, Atkins, Krenwinkel, and Kasabian are indicted for the Tate murders. And then the five of them plus Van Houten are also indicted for the LaBianca murders. So Vincent Bugliosi is assigned as the prosecutor for the case. And Manson, backing up a second. Vincent Bugliosi he very much wants to try all of the defendants at the same time. So he pushes for this and actually succeeds. So they're going to have one trial, and it ends up being a trial of Manson, Van Houten, Krenwinkel, and Atkins. Kasabian is not tried. We'll get into that. And Watson, Tex Watson, there was political entanglements in terms of getting him extradited from Texas. So he was not there for the trial with Manson, but he's tried separately later on. Manson was originally defended by Ronald Hughes, a defense attorney. And then the women had their own defense attorneys, but they're all tried together, like I said. But Manson eventually wanted to replace Hughes, and he did so successfully and got his own defense attorney named Irving Kanarik. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Ronald Hughes stayed on as Leslie Van Houten's defensive counsel. But this is where it gets a little crazy again. Because towards the end of the trial, there was a day where Ronald Hughes does not show up. He disappeared. His body was found later on in 1971. And more than one family member, Manson family member, has admitted, although anonymously, that Manson ordered the murder of Ronald Hughes because he was displeased with his strategy in the case. It's never been proven. Nobody has ever been charged in in the death of Ronald Hughes. In fact, from what I understand, it's never actually been 100% proven that he was murdered. There was no cause of death found. I think he was camping or something like that. But a family member who was a friend of Squeaky Fromm has gone on record saying that Squeaky Fromm, Lynette Squeaky Fromm, has said that the Manson family is responsible for up to 35 to 40 murders, and that Ronald Hughes was the first of the retaliation murders. Now, the only ones that have ever been proven are the Hinman murder, the Tate murders, and the LaBianca murders. But it's definitely possible. Just one more little footnote in what can only be called a chilling story. Anyway, early on, attorneys reached a deal with Susan Atkins, and they told her that they would not pursue the death penalty if she would testify before the grand jury. So this is before the trial phase. They're at the grand jury, and she agrees. She tells the grand jury that there is no limit to what she would do for Charles Manson. She's completely emotionless. She describes the Tate murders, and she tells the grand jury that she felt dead after the murders, and that, quote, "I feel dead now." And then it was after her testimony that the grand jury decided to indict the six family members in the murders that I mentioned above. And then, like I said, Watson was not tried at the same time, but he's tried later. And then they get into jury selection. The jury had to go through quite an ordeal. Not only were they having to deal with the horrific details of this case, they were sequestered for 225 days. Up until that time, it was longer than any previous jury. I don't know since then, but it definitely is on record as one of the longest sequestered juries of all time. Opening statements for the case began on July 24, 1970. Manson enters the courtroom with a freshly cut bloody X carved into his forehead. He said in a statement, "I have X'd myself from your world." Ludicrous. The primary witness for Bugliosi was Linda Kasabian. That's why she's not being tried. She accompanied the family to both the Tate and the LaBianca murders, but she had not actually participated in the murders themselves. She was the lookout and the getaway driver. And so she was granted immunity in order for her to testify. In exchange for her testimony, she was granted immunity, and she was the key witness against Manson. So on trial, starting in July, was Manson, Krenwinkel, Atkins, Van Houten. Am I missing anybody? I don't think so. Let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, there's four of them. Manson, Krenwinkel, Van Houten, and Atkins. Under examination and cross-examination, Kasabian was determined to be a very credible witness. She gave good, clear testimony despite the fact that the defense attorneys tried to discredit her as a junkie and an LSD user. And on top of all of that, her testimony was corroborated by many other witnesses. And so things were going well for the prosecution. Now, keep in mind, I don't want to go into too much of the legal details. I'm at an hour just on part two here. But Manson never actually committed the physical act of murder. It was definitely not a clear-cut case. Vincent Bugliosi was going for murder one against Manson and the three women, but it was definitely up in the air whether he could convince a jury that Manson should be convicted of murder, because not one time did he stab, shoot, or hold somebody down. He was never in the room when the murders occurred. So Bugliosi was basically trying to convince the jury that he was the mastermind and should still be convicted of murder, despite the fact that he never physically murdered anybody. It was a very tough sell for a jury to come back with a guilty verdict I mean, it looks so obvious to us having all the details, but in order to actually prove it to a jury beyond, you know, reasonable doubt, that was a tough sell. So there was a ton of work done by the prosecution team. Vincent Bugliosi did a massive amount of investigation on his own along with his team. And after 22 weeks of testimony, on November 16, 1970, the prosecution finally rested. It was an incredibly long, drawn-out process with so many details and witnesses and testimony. It was just, it was incredible. So there was a short recess for 3 days after the prosecution rested, and then the trial resumed. The defense rested without calling a single witness. Shocking everybody, of course. The three women defendants began shouting that they wanted to testify. And so the attorneys went to the judge's chambers, and the defense attorneys made it clear that they were opposed to their clients testifying because they were under the influence of Manson, and they were afraid that their clients would take all the blame and try to absolve Manson completely. And this was all accurate. The women had come back into the courtroom at some point, and they had also carved X's into their forehead. It's just not normal behavior by any means, but Manson had done it, so they did it. Not only that, Manson's other followers were outside the courtroom, like protesting and making a scene. And in the courtroom, the three women would often make a scene. Manson tried to get a mistrial because he held up a newspaper during the trial that said, "Manson guilty, Nixon says." Obviously, Nixon being the president. And he tried to get a mistrial because that newspaper would, because the jury had seen it, cause the jury to be biased towards a guilty verdict. But the judge said, no, that's not the case, blah, blah. So they were just doing all these crazy things. And at one point, there's a little tidbit that one of the women defendants may have tried to murder Vincent Bugliosi. Not really, but she lunged towards him and knocked over a display, an evidence exhibit display, like an easel, and it hit him in the back of the head. But what people suspect that she was actually trying to do was lunging for a knife that was in evidence. So from then on, whenever they were in the courtroom, the knives had to be under guard and well away from them, because who knows what these crazy women would do. I mean, it was insanity from beginning to end. But the women clearly were still under the influence of Manson, so they did not want them to testify. The judge, a man named Judge Older, declared that the right to testify, however, took precedence. And so he declared that the women should get their chance to testify. So Atkins is sworn in. Her attorney refused to question her. He didn't ask her a single question. And so they go back to chambers again, and one of the defense attorneys likened questioning his client to aiding a suicide. But then, shockingly, Manson made it clear that he also would like to testify. And I don't have the time or the desire, honestly, to get into all the rubbish that he spews. It's all a bunch of crap. Talking about only, he at some point he said that he doesn't believe in things being wrong. I do what my love tells me to do, and you do what your love tells me to do. It's such bullshit. Like, but I can't even form coherent sentences about what he said because it's so bonkers. But if you want to read it, you can read the transcript. It's pretty out there. But anyway, he testifies for a while. And then at the end, as he's walking back, he tells the three women defendants, there, now you do not have to testify. So, Kanarik, in his closing statements, the defense attorney tries to argue that Tex Watson was the true mastermind and that Manson was only being targeted because of his lifestyle. He was being persecuted based on stereotypes. But then, you know, closing statements from Bugliosi. He gives a very powerful, well thought out, tidy wrap up of the case. and the jury goes into deliberation. They deliberate for about a week, and on January 25, 1971, they return their verdict. All defendants found guilty on each count of first-degree murder. And then they go to the sentencing phase, and on March 29, 1971, the jury sentences all defendants to death. And then in a separate trial, I'm not even going to get into it, I didn't even get details of it, but Tex Watson also found guilty and also sentenced to death. As the clerk read the sentence, Manson stood up and shouted, quote, "You people have no authority over me," which honestly kind of made me laugh because it was like, are you sure, dude? Because you're going to prison and you're going to be there for a while. And Susan Atkins yelled, "Better lock your doors and watch your kids," which would be terrifying, honestly, if you were there. Because, yeah, I mean, there was six, I guess, five members of the family that were convicted of the murder. There's dozens more that are still devoted to Manson. If I was on that jury or the attorneys or the judge, I would honestly have been terrified, because they can put Manson in prison, but he still had a hold over these people. If he's threatening you, you better take it seriously. Fortunately, I don't believe from anything I read that anybody involved in the case, the jury or the judge or anything, ever had a family member touched. Thank goodness. But that must have been scary. Unfortunately, and I do mean unfortunately, in 1972, the California Supreme Court ruled that the death penalty in California was unconstitutional, and all five of those people that were sentenced to death were instead had their sentences commuted to life in prison. And I think that's unfortunate, honestly. I'm not even going to BS about that. There are times when I think the death penalty should definitely be used. And I know people disagree with me on that, and that's okay. I understand why you disagree, but come on, these people, I really, truly, in my deepest heart, do not believe that they should have been allowed to live. I believe the world would have been a better place if they had been gone for good. But unfortunately, that is not my decision to make. So where are they now? Where are they now? Finishing up here. Leslie Van Houten, incarcerated in California Institution for Women in Corona. According to all reports, she's a model prisoner. She earned a bachelor's degree and a master's degree and long ago has renounced Manson. She's been up for parole 20 times, most recently just now in March of 2022, rejected every time. She's currently 72 years old, more than likely will die in prison. Charles Tex Watson, currently an inmate in Mule Creek State Prison near Sacramento. He apparently converted to Christianity and became an ordained minister in 1981 and got married in 1979. He's fathered four children through conjugal visits with his then wife, Kristen Jones Svege. I'm not sure how to pronounce her last name. S-V-E-G-E. California abolished conjugal visits for prisoners serving life sentences in late 1990s. And probably mostly because of that, him and his wife amicably divorced in 2003. Pretty impressive that he fathered four kids from prison. One of the reasons that California abolished conjugal visits was relatives of Sharon Tate were pissed that someone who was involved in the murders was able to father children despite the fact that he was locked up in prison, and they make a valid point. Watson has been denied parole 17 times, most recently in October of 2021. And according to the parole board, it is because of lack of remorse and remains a public safety risk, is what they say. He's currently 76 years old. Again, more than likely will die in prison. Patricia Krenwinkle, incarcerated at California Institution for Women in Chino. She has earned her bachelor's degree and also has renounced Manson. She has been denied parole 12 times. She's 74 years old, and her next parole hearing is tentatively scheduled for May of 2022. Susan Atkins, of course, like everybody, renounced Manson and became a born-again Christian. She has been married twice while incarcerated, and in September of 2009, she died at age 61 from brain cancer. Now, Lynette Squeaky Fromm, as kind of an end note here, she was obviously not in part of the murders, but she was one of Manson's most dedicated and maniacal followers, and she stayed devoted to Manson even after the trial and arrest and conviction. On September 5, 1975, she pulled a gun and aimed it at then-President Gerald R. Ford. She was quickly disarmed by the Secret Service. Her lawyers argued that because there was no bullet in the chamber, that she had no real intention of killing the president, but that's a pretty weak case when you're trying to point a gun at the president of the freaking United States. And so she was convicted of attempted assassination and sentenced to life in prison. She remained devoted to Manson. She even escaped briefly so that she could be nearer to him. I think that was in the 80s. So years after the murders, she was still very much a Manson follower. And she was paroled in 2009 at the age of 60. And I learned that today, and that pissed me off. She wasn't part of the murders, of course, but she still was an attempted assassin. And of all the people in the Manson family, which apparently just kind of dissolved shortly after Manson was arrested and convicted, but she was the one that was most devoted to him for the longest period of time, and the parole board was like, all right, you can go. It's like, ugh, gross. Anyway, I don't know what she's up to. I believe she's still alive, and that freaks me out a little bit. Linda Kasabian, as I said, was granted immunity for her testimony. Bugliosi has gone on record saying he does not believe that he would have been able to get a conviction against Manson if it had not been for her testimony, so she was crucial to the case. And she's currently doing her best to live a quiet life with her children. She rarely does interviews, and if she does them, she does them in disguise. She is 72 years old as of right now. And last but not least, of course, Charles Manson served most of his life sentence at Corcoran State Prison. He was denied parole many times over the years, and fortunately for everybody, if you ask me, on November 19, 2017, Manson died of natural causes at 83 years old. Not ending, as I'm literally sitting here talking about him 5 years later, but at least ending the interviews and the fascination that people have with him. As I'm going through this podcast, I'm thinking maybe I shouldn't have done this podcast. Maybe we should just forget about Manson, but whatever. We just can't. It's weirdly fascinating. I don't know about all the other people that are still in prison. To be honest, when I hear that they're born-again Christians and things like that, I try not to judge. And part of me thinks that I hope that's true because I am a Christian myself. And part of me is kind of pissed about that. You're just trying to get out of prison, so you're saying that. And there's just a part of me that thinks nobody could do what they did and then even years later become a Christian. But it could happen. It could happen. And for their sakes, I hope it's true. But I gotta be honest, I have zero sympathy for any of them. I get that they have all said that they reject Manson and that they were brainwashed and that it wasn't, I suppose they do take responsibility for it, but they definitely have made it clear that they were doing it under the influence of Manson. And I don't buy it necessarily. The horrendous, horrific nature of the crime, to me, you don't get to have any point of your life after that where you get to live happily ever after. The fact that they're serving life terms to me is appropriate. I hope that deep down they are remorseful and that they have truly changed their ways, but there is a large part of me that thinks no matter what they say or what they do, that deep down they're just still those disgusting butchers. But it's not for me to judge the heart of people. And I'm glad that that's not up to me. So there you have it. And that is the end of part 2 of Helter Skelter and the Manson family murders. Hope this doesn't keep you up at night. Hope it doesn't make you sick. And I hope you keep coming back to listen to the Curiosity Chronicles next time. Hopefully keeping things a little bit less dark than this, obviously. Going back to ancient times, I think we're going to talk a little bit about gladiators in the Roman Empire. Dive into the history, the types, and the life that gladiators lived while fighting in the arena. I think it'll be really fun. I think it'll be a lot of fun. But until then, my name is Brett Bielsma. I am your host. And until next time, I hope that you stay curious.